From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Shake it, don't break it. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, I can say, is an actor who seems to be attracted to roles where society is in turmoil, be it as Hotspur or Illuminati or Cold Comfort Farm or a role I love him for, Dark City, or maybe something that you all know him for. The show's now in its fourth season on Amazon, Man in the High Castle. Of course, I'm talking about Rufus Sewell. Thanks so much for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Nice to meet you, Elvis.
Nice to meet you. But you do tend to turn up in lots of material where the world is about to shift or shifting in a fairly violent way.
I think those are the worlds that are attracted to me rather than the other way around, though.
Really?
Yeah, I suppose just like with relationships, you know, it's not necessarily the way you think it is. Sometimes it's the other way around. But yes, because actually I'm equally attracted to very light and frothy comedy. In fact, I'd always say it was my forte. But the kind of roles that tend to come my way, especially in larger projects, tend to be, you know, tend to be that kind of thing. I enjoy doing them. Sometimes the biggest challenge is finding a difference in something that on paper looks similar to something I've been offered before. So that's nothing to do with my preferences.
But it certainly comes to, and we can say in a number of these cases, you can play some of these roles for comedy. I mean, we look at Cold Comfort Farm, which is basically a society that was flipping over because of one person, as a matter of fact. That's definitely comedy.
But well, I did that in an effort to change my career. there's been many, over the years, points at which I thought something will show people, you know, something else I can do. It, you know, and actually, the great revolution in my career over the last few years is that I stopped caring about that and just started to enjoy myself and not worry about trying to effect a change in my career.
You just enjoy what I'm doing. But what was that? Because clearly you've always got work. Work has always come to you.
Well,
you've worked really steadily.
I've worked steadily, but that's because you're not aware of people when they're unemployed, do you? There's no live video feed of someone sitting there watching TV and bitching.
How about this? There are people who, when they're not employed, you miss them when you want to see them.
Yes, and no one misses me. Exactly. I get your point. No, I joke. But the work that has come my way has always been quite difficult to sift through for stuff that I will do, because for many years in the past, despite little attempts to shift the way I was viewed, like, you know, Cold Comfort Farm or The Very Thought of You or all these different comedies that I've done, or Shakespeare Retold, which was one of my favourite things, that actually I had enormous fun doing them and people liked them, but it didn't really change the general tenor of the work that came my way, which tended to be this kind of, you know, heavies and, you know, stuff that I enjoyed doing, but sometimes a little bit tiring that I didn't get the chance to fully express what I was capable of. That basically I'd be in the ring with one arm tied behind my back a lot of the time, trying to find interesting ways of doing footwork to make it, to liven it up a little. So what that has meant is that I've had to learn, or at least in the past, to not think of anything up to 6 months as being unemployment. Because sometimes it took at least that long to be offered something, even within that range, that very limited range of roles, that was worth doing. Because a lot of mediocre bad guy stuff would come my way before a good bad guy that was worth thinking, ah, sod it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I've got to say that one of the things that you must have liked about reading John Smith in The Man in the High Castle is that he's really a man who is devoted to duty. And given the horror of that situation, which for the people who haven't seen it yet, it's basically from Philip K. Dick's astonishingly and terrifying short novel about what the world would be like had the Axis powers won World War II. And you're an American who, in this last season, promotes the Reich Marshal. But in the current season, season four, becomes a whole other person. We'll talk about that later. In seeing that, and he's a man who really is devoted to duty.
I would question that. In fact, I would say
because it's cost him a lot what he's done.
Well, I would say, yes, it has, but that I would say that's just because he hasn't made great choices. I mean, what I mean is, even in terms of what he thinks he's doing, he's done that wrong. But I would say that what the audience is getting in John Smith is the conflict between the story trying to push him one way and me trying to push him back. And that, I think, is the central crisis of John Smith, that basically what attracted me to it, it was an opportunity to voice my frustrations with typecasting by playing out that battle in a person. That wasn't necessarily the way that it was presented to me that way, but it's been an interesting journey to try to maintain that conflict, because sometimes the expediency of trying to get a show going for four seasons is very tempting to remove some of his intelligence and remove some of his conflict in order to make him become a more effective cog in the machine, i.e. sometimes you need for ballast a monodirectional bad guy. And sometimes I would have to push back against that so I don't lose detail. I've always maintained, or what I've always tried to keep contact with was my initial interest in the part, is that it's what happens to a normal person who has equal share of good and bad in them, as opposed to this idea that all the people who ended up being Nazis were Nazis because they were inherently evil. Nazism itself is inherently evil, but it took over an entire country. It nearly took over England. It nearly took over America.
And look where it is now.
And look where it is now. It breeds in humans, not in bad guys. If it only worked in people who are inherently bad, it wouldn't be the problem, but it corrupts. And what was interesting to me about Smith is he was someone who had moral luck, would not have been in this position. But this is a person who, in our version of events, would never have been pushed in this direction, but there was receptive ground in him. And if we go against the idea that that is possible, it's very comforting. That's why, as I've said before, you know, there are so many movies in which Nazis are werewolves and aliens and vampires. The idea that they are monsters is comforting to those of us that think, well, if I'd been there, I'd have done this and I'd have done that. But I think it's much more morally responsible to represent someone who is more like us. You know, it doesn't mean that we don't have psychopaths in us.
But it gives you something to play as well, does it not?
Yes, but it also means there's a point to playing it. Not just something to play. I mean, you can just play 100% evil too.
Well, but no, I guess I'm saying, by the way, this is the treatment. My guest, who's in constant disagree with me, is Rufus Sewell, who's, yeah, of course, playing John Smith in Man in the High Castle. I guess what I'm saying, something to play is it gives you context. So you're not just playing text. So you're not just doing it, as you put it, in this monomaniacal fashion. The reason I brought up his commitment to duty is that's where the conflict arises for him, is because
I think it's his commitment to keeping his family alive, and that,
well, that becomes a big part of it too.
But I think that's all it is. That isn't to say that something that starts off as a truth cannot then be calcified into a lie. That this is the narrative he tells himself. It might have even started as an impulse that was entirely, you know, pure in and of itself, that his desire to protect his family made him make these choices, which I would view objectively as wrong, very, very wrong. But that was the story he carried along with himself. I'm not saying that that didn't become a lie, but it wasn't his predilection towards duty.
Well, I'm not saying a predilection, but I think it's something that it's fascinating, because also the way you play him, he's somebody who seems to be disgusted by power as he gets close to it.
Exactly, and disgusted by that in himself. Like I've, you know, my idea of this, the idea of alternate histories, is that John Smith is someone who is in close, uncomfortable contact with his own alternate history inside himself. The alternate history that you might get, or alternate future that you get glimpses of, or more than glimpses of, in season four. But he is not, he's a very, very intelligent man. And one of my points of issue with the writing always was, if in order to move forward the story, Smith had to become more stupid than me, rather than more intelligent than me when he was, then I would fight it. And I don't think he is unaware of the terrible bargain he's made. And I think that that eats away at him. But sometimes the doubters are more dangerous.
But I think, though, and especially in the second half of season three, as his rise really starts to overtake him, he's really caught in this slipstream of standing, unfortunately, in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Then we really get to see his bemusement become almost this physical force for him.
Mm-hmm.
and that you find a physical way to play that. I mean, you can almost see him, not almost see, we can see him fighting his distaste for it.
Yes. I mean, that is one of the interesting things about season three, but definitely season four, is that Smith's journey kind of mirrors my own, that Smith finds himself becoming the figurehead of something which he actually personally finds distasteful. But if he steps off it, it's at the cost of his family. So there's no letting go because you're on a cliff. So he must, his only chance of survival and the chance of survival of his family is to continue climbing on this edifice.
But funny, as you're talking, I'm thinking about that scene from the last episode of season three when he's on the phone with his wife.
Yes.
And we can see something dying in him when we hear her telling him what she's not going to do.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk to you about the way you played that, because that really is, I mean, if you think back, because we watched them all, just think about the, you can see him giving himself a reason to leave the house in the first season.
Yeah.
By the end of the last season, he's surrounded by these people who really are lifting him up, and he's horrified by it, but he has no place to go. And you played it so beautifully because you can't really say anything to her on the phone.
No, exactly. And those, but thank you. Those moments are incredibly rich for me to play, because that for me is the story of this man. It's that, you know, the machine that he's tied himself to protect his family is turning round and asking to claim his children one after another. He is not unaware of this. He's also not unaware of, you know, his life has become empty in this way. That's what I'm saying, that he has two opposite journeys. One is he gets higher and higher and higher, and the opposite journey is his self-disgust and his disgust at the regime that he has to support, in fact, become a figurehead of, gets stronger and stronger. So those two things exist at the same time. Very interesting to play. But there's also the sense of betrayal in there, because she's turned around as though she said, look at what you've become. It was not without her urging, you know. So there's a lot of difficult things to play.
Her complicity, really.
Absolutely. Not only complicity, but, you know, she'd been a great supporter and in her own way, as culpable as him.
To me, I think the fascinating part of all this is that it's an ongoing thing. And the sad fact of this, too, is that he's enough of a manipulator that he's very successful in being close to power.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the, I don't know how much I can talk about. When is this going to be on?
Oh, in a few weeks. So at least the first couple of episodes
okay,
will be
so,
on.
Well, you know, when they came up, the idea of this, or actually when we came up, because we were talking about it together, the idea of this, and if there's an alternate universe.
Universe, yes.
In which case there would be an alternate John Smith. The idea that he would be a salesman, they came up with. But what I wanted to concentrate on was the fact that that was quite an interesting choice, because I believe, and I've said this before, and I think some people might take issue with this, that I think what makes him such a successful maneuverer within the world that we know, dangerous and vicious though it may be, is the same thing that would make him a very, very good salesman. Is he an expert reader? An anticipator of people's impulse. In fact, I would call it empathy. That what makes him dangerous is a kind of caustic empathy. That he can see what you are feeling. He can predict your behavior because he can place himself in your position. So that, for me, it kind of spun me out in that direction, that it's a shame I didn't have more material to use it with. But actually, that was what I think is his kind of secret ingredient.
We're going to take a break. We're talking about the dangers of ratiocination with my guest, Rufus Sewell. We're talking about, of course, the man in the High Castle. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm continuing to disagree with my guest, Rufus Sewell, the stars of Man in the High Castle. It's The Treatment. But that ability of his to read people in power and to know what to say to them mm-hmm. was something that I feel like you sort of found, and then the characters start to be shaped around your take on him being able to do that. Am I mistaken?
I don't know. I like to think so. One of the great things about something that could have been a disadvantage, like an early change in showrunners and a couple of changes of regime, have always still preserved what was quite special about this show, was the involvement of a number of the key actors. And, you know, we weren't the ones making key decisions, but our input after a while was very much valued, because we were consistent and it was quite clear that we weren't trying to protect, you know, our screen time or any kind of bullshit like that, that we've cared very much about what this show could be. We were great believers in the idea of this show.
Did you get a chance to read the short story before you would?
I didn't read the short story once I realized. As soon as the script arrived, I did a Wikipedia check. And within a couple of seconds, I knew that John Smith was not in the original story.
But it'll give you context, though.
That actually gave me reason to want to reject the whole thing, because having only read one episode at the time, my instinct was that in a situation where they add a bad guy, it's for mechanics, i.e. in order for the machine to work, you need a kind of dark North Star. I was not interested in that. And that was when I spoke to Frank Spotnitz, and he assured me that that was not the case. And he showed me secretly episode 2, which was already written, in which you see an attack from his perspective, the scene with his family. And I was given a couple of clues as to the Thomas storyline. Then I accepted. So, yes, I did not want to read the short story for a while, because I didn't think it would, you know, be very useful to me. And also I thought it would piss me off. But then I did, because I thought my job actually was to read as much history about the people who went along with Nazism and about Nazi history. So I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. I read Albert Speer's book, Inside the Third Reich. I read the book about Albert Speer that was written. I read as much as I could, and then I read the book, because I just wanted to know what story did people tell themselves about how they weren't bad guys.
But what's striking too, and the show gets that, and your character really seems to encapsulate it, is that it's a hard book to read just because the awfulness in the short story is so deadpan.
Yes, exactly. It's accepted. And that's what was so, you know, especially I think what really took people about the pilot in particular, because that was the first anyone got it, obviously, was the casualness in which massive implications are inferred just by possibly a tense or a throwaway line. It's that kind of brilliant thing that Tom Stoppard is capable of doing. You can find out that someone would know.
Yeah.
You can find out that someone is dead because of a tense that is used. And you think, hold on, what? You know, that you're not spoon-fed. And that's what you get from episode 1, is this, you work out what has happened. You're not talked through it like an idiot, you know. And that's one of the great things about the storytelling.
It's so interesting, by the way, we're talking to my guest who's finally stopped disagreeing with me, Rufus Sewell. It's the treat when we're talking about Man in the High
Castle.
It's
always a good way to start.
I guess you're flirting with me. The show's on Amazon. But so often, when you brought up Stoppard, you reminded me of that. Characters who have a precision with language. We can see this with John in the way that, not only the way he speaks, but when he speaks.
Yes.
And that, working with Stoppard, you've got to have that, because the language itself is so demanding and precise.
Yes, I suppose. And what I really love about Tom Stoppard is that, yes, he's enormously intellectual, etc., but also there's something in England, what we call blokey, about it. He knows the difference between a dick and a in language. Like you bleep both those words in terms of insults. You know, it's not all flowery stuff.
But
there's an earthiness and a humanity and a kind of basicness when needed.
But that's the precision I'm getting to.
Exactly.
I mean, what you're talking about.
Precision not being something flighty, but actually something very rooted in the earth, in reality.
And I would say, too, that so many of these characters that you played, and I brought up Hotspur for a reason, because I thought your Hotspur was incredible.
Oh, thank you.
And one of my favorite characters in Shakespeare. So, I mean, that character's precision in language, mm-hmm. and inability to control that precision sometimes.
Yes.
as compared to John, who is almost pained by the way he's constantly aware. In fact, that seems to be for him. You talked about this kind of caustic empathy, the danger of him that he suffers with everybody he stands next to.
Yes. Or at least he is aware of the suffering, you know. You can do that. That's what I'd say, that, you know, that his doubt, his inner turmoil does not make him safe. You know, there's a reason that it's the people who want to prove their faith are the ones that strap the bombs on, you know. That's what makes him so very dangerous. But I think, yes, this idea of precision is what I've always loved. And I think the reason I've always loved Stoppard, and it's the same with Smith, it's like, there is a precision in silence as well, you know, which words are used. Well, I mean, it's also, I don't know how much of Smith, where it came from. There's a strange alchemy that always happens when an actor plays the role for a while and the writers are watching. It's, you know, it's some, the process I've enjoyed very much of creating John Smith. And I think it's been remarkable, really, considering that there's been so many different writers over the course of the four seasons, that there is that cohesion, you know.
It's interesting, too, because especially we see the contrast when they cross into the new dimension in season four. I really got to realize, and it's something that runs through a lot of the characters you play, too, there's a presentational aspect to John Smith. I mean, he's kind of hail fellow well met as a salesman, and but still trying to read you to see what he can get out of you and what you have to say. And he used that as a way to kind of closet himself in the first three seasons as a Nazi. He used that presentational aspect to keep people from asking him certain questions.
Yes.
And but so many characters you play, I mean, they have a presentational aspect to them. And I wonder if that's something that excites you about a lot of these people.
Yes, it is, actually. I remember the first times when I was very, very young, when I saw actors, before I was even aware of acting, I remember seeing Charles Laughton in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Just this one scene, I think he was in the rafters with Esmeralda, and he was saying something, laughing about being about as ugly as the man in the moon. And I remember being aware of this monster on the outside and this little soul flickering behind the eyes. And I was very, very young, but I was really taken with Charles Laughton. And I was also really taken. It's interesting because I've recently worked with Anthony Hopkins, which is, you know, fabulous for me because he's always been one of my very favourite actors. But I told my brother about that and he said, well, remember, do you remember when we were very young and we saw magic together and how struck you were? And I didn't remember that, but I was really young and similarly struck by Anthony Hopkins. And there is that, I don't know if it's presentational, but there is,
the
difference between the outside and the inside. So I suppose it comes down to taste and what moves you. And in terms of when we were talking earlier about my approach to Smith giving me something to do, it's more, it gives me a reason to do it because there is, you know, what do you want to say becomes a thing that you start to think about after a while. You know, when it's not just about, obviously you want to get jobs, you know, but if you do get a job, why? Do you want to? What is it that you want to say? And I've realized that there's always been something about that, the difference between the inside and the outside and how they kind of have this strange little dance. And so I suppose it's that.
So funny you mentioned magic because that really is presentational and, mm-hmm. and the superego versus the id
exactly.
Right before our very eyes.
Yeah.
And it's almost when you're doing something, is you're making a little bit of a compact with the audience. That thing you're talking about with Laughton or with Hopkins, or they show us, it's not apparent, or I should say evident, to anybody else there in the room with as those characters, but they let us know what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, as a person, I'm a lot more kind of dog-like than people realize.
How do you
know? I mean, in terms of my energy, I mean, I'm quite bouncy and I talk a lot.
So like Labrador Retriever and not a Doberman Pinscher? Yeah,
no, exactly. But I play a lot of Dobermans, you know, or rather I'm a dog that gets cast as a cat. And what that does to me, actually, really, me on screen, the energy I have is me just having to keep still.
But that energy, I think, is often belied in the character because we can see so. Even that presentational aspect I'm talking about with John Smith in the first three seasons, we can see what's being held back.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that awareness of what opening up will do. And he's open in a way that's still a little cagey when we see it in the other dimension. But but still, and that openness becomes part of the presentation too.
Yeah.
And the energy, I think, is always there. I mean, because we can see the physical tension in him. I mean, he's constantly doing this with one of his hands.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just flexing, but making a fist, so we're just stretching my hand out for... given that this is radio.
Yes, otherwise who knows what they'd be imagining.
Yes, but you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And I find you find physical aspects to concentrate on with these characters just so we get a chance to see what it is that they're not showing people.
Yeah, it's a kind of internal rhythm. Yeah, no, I think that's interesting. I haven't thought about it a lot, but it does make sense to me.
You hadn't thought about it?
Well, no, I mean, I hadn't thought about it unifying my work.
That's what I mean. Okay, because
I suppose... It's not that I've thought about it. Maybe I've just accepted it. It's not something I struggle with. But at the same time, when I do, this is something I talk about. I mean, when I talk about having to work within a relatively narrow range, up until maybe a couple of years ago, of roles that come my way, with exceptions, I really enjoy the opportunity to sometimes do something quite different to that, you know, which people rarely see. In fact... You know, my favorite work that I've done has always been the other work, you know, the work that I'm not known for. So when people talk about typecasting or my strengths are not, I believe, the things that I do most often. Actually, my strengths, this is not a complaint. I'm quite happy with the you know, state of affairs at the moment. The things that come easily to me, the things that I can just always do on instinct. And it was certainly the case when I was at drama school, was the comedy. That's the thing that I've got that I was in danger of thinking would be where I'd be stuck.
Is that your fear, you'd be cut typecast and doing comedy?
That was my fear at drama school, because whatever I did, people would just laugh and it would really piss me off, you know. So when I got opportunities to play kind of, though I did struggle when I was first playing romantic leads because I didn't see myself that way at all. I had every success I'd ever had would be playing hunchbacks and, you know, like whatever, but extreme characters. To actually play someone who's supposed to be just like a normal, unlumpen person with no limp, and I became incredibly self-conscious. So my early work on screen when I'm supposed to be the young whatever, I'm stricken. You can see it's like I've got a rod up my back. You know, it took me a while to just think, you know what, you're okay. That's enough.
But what was the thing that helped you to get past that self-consciousness?
Age.
Really?
Yeah, because I wasn't wrong. You know, that wasn't what I did. It wasn't, you know, I came out of drama school and suddenly got cast for what I appeared to be to other people, which was the opposite of not only the way I saw myself, but where I thought my strengths were. So in order to work, I was suddenly playing, you know, the new young buck in a suit. And if you watch my early work, like in Gone to Seed or whatever, which is this first TV series, I just look, I've been nailed to a wall. My voice is like this, and I, you know, it would be kind of adorable if I didn't find it so painful. But yeah, just getting over myself. It took a while, you know.
I'm sorry to tell you, we're out of time. You've got to come back and do the show again, please.
I'd love to. Thanks, Alex.
My guest, of course, my pleasure. My guest is Rufus Sewell, who does more than just walk around with a rod up his back. Watch him in The Man in the High Castle on Amazon, its fourth season. Recording engineer here at NPR West is Marcia Caldwell. The show is mixed and edited by Kat Yore. I don't have a rod anywhere. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.